Welcome back to Rockstock Channel. It is Tuesday, April 9th, and we are very happy to have back on Rockstock Channel, Iola Hughes of Row Motion. We interviewed you, I don't know how many months ago, maybe 6 months ago, and Rodney has articulated his view that he has been outlier bullish on battery storage. And a lot of that bullishness, I think, comes from reading your great research, Iola. So you have recently been, have a new title, same job as the head of
research
at Low Motion. I participated in a webinar you did, 2 months ago or so with your outlook for this year. There's a lot of negativity in the world of lithium. We were very focused on lithium. There has been a significant supply cut story, right? And we've been thinking for a long time that supply could never keep up with demand. And here we are, supply, we're having cuts. So we don't know if there are any kind of demand surprises, but when we listened to you 2 months ago, you seem to be pretty bullish. And we have a bunch of slides you've shared with us, and we appreciate that very much. Rodney is going to do the bulk of the questioning here. We just wanted to have the lead in on that, but this is very much going to be a data intense, demand focused, lithium driver conversation from one of the leading sources in the industry, Row Motion, that's really carved out a great niche in providing high quality content in this space. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about Row Motion and what you provide, a little advertisement for yourself, Iola, and your how we could find you on on X and the like. And just by the way, before I forget, just a reminder to all listeners, if you like this video, please like and subscribe to Rockstock Channel. Click the notification bell so you can be made aware when all videos kind of come out. Please follow Rodney and me on X at LithiumIonVol or at RodneyHooker13. And a summary of this interview will be in our upcoming Lithium Bull for April. If you want to get those emailed directly to your email box, please register your email at rkequity.com. So Iola, tell us a little bit about, yourself and Row Motion.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having back on, Howard and Rodney. Really enjoyed our conversation we had, some point last year. So it's great to be back and looking forward to the discussion today. So as you mentioned, I'm Iola Hughes from Row Motion. I've been with Row Motion for about 4.5 years. Essentially, we're a research house, a consultancy, covering the energy transition, really with our specialty lying in the EV and battery markets, with the key focus there being battery demand outlooks and forecasting. We do cover various other fields within the energy transition. So we look at EV charging and infrastructure, course, the EV market, stationary storage, battery recycling, battery technology trends, also, the impact of renewables and how that all interlinks. We provide data and insights to, various key stakeholders and players across the value chain. We also host a number of events throughout the year, as well as kind of consulting that we do for single clients and that sort of thing. You can check us out at rowmotion.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn or on Twitter. And then my personal Twitter as well is Romo Iola, where I often share insights across the kind of different battery demand markets.
That's great. I remember some of your commentary on charging and the like,
among the other things. But
we definitely want to focus on the kind of lithium demand drivers. Yeah. So we want so much focus on that. And I know you have some commentary on politics as well. But that's a bit random. But we really want to kind of get a gravel on, US seems to be slowing down. China seems to be still kind of going gangbusters, plug-ins versus battery, full battery electric, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, again, I'm going to leave it to Rodney to take it from here.
Great. Hello, good to have you back. And the good news is your, estimate for, batteries this year is almost identical to mine. I think I'm 1.365 gigawatt, 1365 gigawatt hours, and you're 37% up on, I think, about a terawatt. So we're right in the ballpark.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The views are slightly different on where and when your China EV numbers are a bit higher than mine, and I've got rest of world. But you're getting a lot of press, and I'm not sure it's false press, but it seems the EV thematic has swung back to China. If you remember in 2021, Europe almost sold more EVs than China, and now China's nearly 2.5-3 times. So if you can just give us a sense on your thoughts. You've got a good slide. We'll put up, you know, what the change was in 2023 in penetration. And there were a couple of markets in Europe that were down, which is a rare. So I guess flag for the listeners what your EV demand estimate is and any of the possible dangers to that coming up short.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. So in 2023, we saw just under 14 million units sold across all vehicle classes. That was a 32% year-on-year increase. 2024, you know, despite the negative sentiment that is certainly widespread in the market, we are expecting relatively strong growth again. So 27% year-on-year growth to 17.6 million. I'd say 2023 was, you know, it was a challenging year for some countries, particularly in the European market. However, when we look at kind of the general sense of how things evolved, we do see penetration rates increasing in most major countries. You know, notable increases, of course, China being the largest market, and sales there continue to kind of march on. Within the US market, US and Canada, I would say it's also a kind of similar picture. You know, month on month, we do see, again, lots of negative sentiment, but the sales, in terms of sales growth each month, seems to be quite consistent. The European market, which is typically follows a much more kind of cyclical and seasonality, has definitely suffered from a few different variations. So just mentioning a few. So Germany last year saw a fall in penetration rate. You know, there's a reason behind that. And ultimately, it was down to the removal of plug-in hybrid subsidies, which we saw take place at the start of the year. Yeah, I think it's the start of the year or the middle of the year. Got to check that. Essentially, what that meant was that we saw plug-in hybrid sales fall off a cliff. And as a result, the overall EV penetration rate did fall in Germany. However, when we look specifically at BEV sales, we did see that increase in the region. So, you know, it's certainly not maybe as bad news as that picture does paint. The other market where we also did only see a very small increase in penetration rate was in the UK. Ultimately, the UK had a strong year for total vehicle market sales. In the UK, you have some issues around a kind of affordability, which is actually a wider European issue. And 2024 is the first year where we see the new ZEV mandates coming in the UK. So we are expecting the UK to have a stronger year this year. More broadly, looking at 2024, you know, taking each region individually. So in China, we're expecting over 10 million units. Which is the strongest growth rate. So we're forecasting 29% year-on-year growth there. Ultimately, what you have there is a mature market in some ways. The availability of affordable vehicles is certainly helping that market in a significant way. You also have the continuation of stable legislative support, strong commitments from OEMs, you know, a supply chain which is now quite well developed, which is really boosting how things are progressing in the Chinese market. The European market, as I kind of mentioned, it's going to be a difficult year. We're forecasting 3.6 million units. Certain markets, you know, things are looking particularly bad. In Germany, at the end of the year, the government announced that they would be removing the BEV subsidy as well, which was quite a, I guess, surprise move, and that really came on the back of some budgetary issues that were happening in Germany. And that removal of the subsidy, we do expect to have a significant effect. You know, from in Germany specifically, we're forecasting a growth rate of 1% in terms of EV sales this year. So that certainly, and given Germany's position within the whole of the EU, is expecting to have a kind of a big impact there. The other thing to note for Europe is, really, this is a transitionary year. that the key driver in terms of EV sales in the European market is CO2 legislation, and the next step change is coming in 2025. So we are expecting, you know, this year to almost be that kind of that transition as we move towards 2025, where we'll see OEMs really have to step up their commitments to meeting those targets. And then, yeah, the US market, you know, there's, as I mentioned a few times, a lot of negative sentiment in the US market. A lot of that is coming from, you know, the big three automakers. However, when we do look at, you know, where sales are actually coming from, the big three aren't really the ones who are accounting for those sales right now. So sometimes that sentiment has to be slightly taken with a pinch of salt. You know, we do see sales growth relatively continuing in a relatively positive way, but we aren't expecting, I guess, anything groundbreaking yet in terms of the US market. There's lots of production ramp up, which is underway. You know, we've heard many automakers having a lot of headaches with this issues. And then you also have the uncertainty in the US around being an election year. So you could almost say it's a bit of a transitionary year for the US as well, as we progress to 2025, 2026, where we'll start to see more impact of things like production facilities coming online, EPA emission standards ramping up. And that's when we'll really start to see demand taking off.
Let's say Europe, I have an identical forecast to you of 15 and 3.6, but you know, you touched on it. Yes, China has regulatory support and so on. But one of the things, you know, that stands out for me is the broad range of affordable vehicles across the entire price range. And in Europe, I put this up at the one-for-one presentation last year, the ID.4 base model in the UK is $45,000, and you can buy a fully spec SUV in China for 20. So
yeah,
one of the ways to solve that, of course, is to allow Chinese exports into Europe, but that seems to be a problem. So when are we going to see a broad affordable range?
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say it's probably one of the biggest issues in the European market right now is the affordable vehicle issue. So the European market, much more than the US market, when you look at the kind of distribution of best-selling ICE vehicles, you know, there's a huge amount of them which fall under that 30,000 euro mark. So of the top 10 best-selling models, 8 of them are under $30,000, under 30,000 euros. So really, you know, that is reflective of what individuals or what customers in Europe are looking for. We've got a few announcements of vehicles coming through. So you've got the likes of the Citroen EC3, which goes for 23,000 euros. You also have the Renault 5, which sits around 25,000 euros. So these vehicles are coming, but, you know, it's really the case right now of, you know, orders are open, pre-orders will begin in September. And then the two other ones which we do have on the market, or really coming into the market, are the Dacia Spring, you know, ultimately a Chinese vehicle, and Leap Motors with their TO3. So what we are expecting is to see more of these Chinese vehicles coming into the market. Certainly that's going to help with the affordability issue. On the other side of that, you do have the EU Parliament, you know, looking to essentially launching a probe into Chinese vehicles, Chinese-made vehicles, whether there's been unfair government support given to these vehicles. That's currently ongoing, and we can expect some announcement in terms of tariffs or kind of anything put against those vehicles later this year. But we can already see certain countries, France, for example, they changed their subsidies, their eco bonus, essentially to prevent Chinese vehicles accessing that. As a result of that, we saw players like Dacia Spring introduce their own massive subsidy discounts within the German market. So it's all quite a reactionary market right now. Everyone is, you know, trying to get the best deal, and it seems like the price wars that we saw over the last few years are really continuing in quite a strong way.
Iona, one of the things that keeps popping up now is, you know, the potential of a delay in the ban of the sale of ICE vehicles in the EU being pushed out to a later date, efficient fuels. Suddenly, Europe is at the forefront of going for EVs is now seeming to be wavering a little bit. How, you know, realistic or how, you know, how big are those threats to delays EV adoption?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're particularly likely in terms of an actual kind of pushback of that target. The kind of key advocate for pushing back the 2035 figure comes from Porsche, who managed to get that e-fuel allowance added last year. So, you know, we don't consider EU law is basically a lot more, I guess, quite locked in a sense. You also have a lot of OEMs in the European market who have committed based on those targets. Quite interestingly, last year we did see the UK push back there or adjust their target from 2030 to 2035. But I think the likelihood of that, you know, being pushed further to 2040 is relatively unlikely within the European market. Certainly the commitment does seem quite strong from both individual countries and also the OEMs. One of the interesting things which we have been seeing, I mean, this is slightly pivoting over to the US market now, is the, I guess, the re-arisal of plug-in hybrids. So the changes in the EPA emission standards, which came out just last month, there were a slight dampening on the original EPA emission standards. However, you know, the end goal was quite similar, but the real change was kind of along the way. And one of the key things there being is how plug-in hybrids are essentially rated based on their CO2 emissions. So, you know, there's a large discrepancy between real-world plug-in hybrid CO2 emissions and, you know, what they're kind of given as a rating. So what the EPA standard was looking to do originally was bring it in line with the real-world standards. Essentially, what's going to happen is it's bringing it a little bit closer, but it's still quite a generous rating for plug-in hybrids and is going to allow them to continue to be used, you know, for the coming years as kind of a transitionary vehicle. And, you know, we've seen GM announce that they're going to be getting back into the plug-in hybrid space. So that's certainly something that we're seeing more of come through. The Chinese market as well, plug-in hybrid sales are going quite strong. BYD kind of leading the way there. And an interesting thing in China as well, we see quite a few of these range extended EVs. So they're a bit like a plug-in hybrid, but they're primarily an EV, kind of secondary an ICE vehicle rather than the other way around. So you have a bit of bigger battery pack with those. So for battery demand, that's quite interesting. The European market is almost unique in that way because because in the European market, plug-in hybrids from 2027 are going to be assessed based on kind of real-world CO2 emissions. So we do expect those to kind of fall off a cliff a lot sooner in Europe than, say, in the US or in the Chinese market, and certainly faster than in markets like Latin America. We're expecting plug-in hybrids to make up a big market share in the coming years.
China came out of nowhere last year in terms of export of vehicles. They shot up from and also ran into number one. I think there were about 1 million EVs exported out of 4 in total. This year, I have quite a big number for that. So in your mind, is China that's exporting these well-priced vehicles going to sew up a lot of the rest of the world market by the time the OEMs get their act together?
So it's interesting. So, yeah, we certainly have seen a step up in terms of exports of vehicles. One thing that is worth noting is that a lot of those vehicles which are being exported right now are, you know, Western brands. So you've got the likes of SAIC vehicles, which owns MG. So MG make up a large share of those vehicles. Tesla, of course, being the other one as well. We're certainly expecting to see more of those vehicles come through in terms of the export markets this year. Quite a few of the OEMs as well are kind of looking to build out their own expertise there, so buying things such as ro-ro ships so they can export vehicles. So certainly, you know, in the European market, we are going to see more of these vehicles coming through. That does come as well at a time where, as I mentioned, there is this ongoing investigation into Chinese vehicles. So, you know, if Europe was to, for example, to impose a significant tariff on those vehicles, then we could see less of those going to Europe and perhaps going to other countries, like the Asia-Pacific region or Latin America, where we're already starting to see quite a few of those export vehicles go through. I think the Australian market is quite an interesting one to consider. You know, typically that's been a market served by the likes of Honda and Toyota, you know, an export market, and you know, the likes of BYD there are now really dominating the space and taking up a large amount of market share. So those sort of markets, maybe outside of the three key regions that we typically talk about, we can expect to see a lot of exports going through. And that's even before, I guess, facilities have been set up outside of China for those Chinese brands. So thinking about places like Thailand, Indonesia, where we will see facilities from those Chinese brands in the coming years as well.
And in your mind, you know, Tesla is now sharing its charging network in the US, but if more of the sort of that the new Volvo and so on, the sub 40,000, if we get more EVs into the 20,000 to 40,000 range in the US and more in Europe, you know, are we likely to see, you know, EV penetration kind of back on track and everyone behind it? Is that, you know, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think certainly, like, affordability of the vehicle is the big issue right now. You know, in the European market, in the US market, if people can buy a nice vehicle at a lot lower price, then that's, you know, certainly going to help with sales and penetration rate. Charging does continue to be a major issue in both those markets. You know, Tesla opening up their network does help the picture, but it doesn't solve things. There's still a long way to go. A lot of issues around reliability and uptimes of charges. So it's fun to see some mandates come through from specific states around requiring chargers to be, you know, have 95% or higher uptimes, which will help with, you know, the overall image of electric vehicles. I think that's a big thing right now, is, you know, there's a lot of negative sentiment going on, which almost is like a separate reciprocating cycle. People hear things are going badly, so they think things are going badly, so they're like, okay, well, I'm just going to wait until, you know, EVs are better, or people have worked out these problems with chargers. So it's a whole kind of re-education and at this kind of transitionary period right now, whilst we move over from, you know, early adopters and people who are, you know, understand electric vehicles and can afford them to more of a mass market picture where, you know, we'll see that penetration rate rise.
And if we can move on to battery chemistries, you've got a slide there in terms of LFP, mostly China for now. How's that? I have seen some press about some of the automakers looking now more seriously at LFP. How do you see that balance between that and mid and high nickel and LMFP?
We saw LFP chemistry share end the year just below 40%. So, you know, over the last few years, that really has seen impressive gains. In terms of where that growth comes from or is coming from right now, majority of that is a China story. So in China, LFP share is close to 65%. You know, the dominance of players like BYD, where every single one of their vehicles is LFP, is certainly having a large impact on that. Outside of the Chinese market, the story is you know, less clear. So LFP share outside of China sits at 13%. And again, that is a share which has increased in recent years, and ultimately that comes down to exports. So in the US market, ultimately we're looking at is Tesla, and in the European market, you're also ultimately looking at Tesla, with the exception of kind of, you know, a few BYD exports, a few other models which have been fitted with it. So particularly in the US, where, you know, Tesla still does dominate that market so much, changes in chemistry choice by them really have the potential to swing things quite significantly in terms of that chemistry share split. So a kind of key one with that is, you know, if we do see Tesla using the M3P, the LMFP cell, if they shift over to that completely, then we would see quite a significant shift in kind of battery chemistry share in the US market as a result of that. But, you know, the picture right now is NCM and NCA chemistries are still dominating in the European or kind of outside of China. And what that comes down to ultimately is cell capacity outside of China. There basically is no LFP. And the players that are supplying to the US market, to the European market, typically your Korean and Japanese manufacturers, don't yet have LFP capacity. But you know, that is going to change in the coming years. So when we kind of consider the traditional battery manufacturers outside of China, your likes of SK, Samsung, LG, Panasonic, certainly Panasonic kind of being the exception. The others have all announced LFP plans, production facilities in the US, either Korean market and European market. So the US market is quite interesting. So probably the leading one there in terms of announcing LFP capacity would be LG. So they announced 16 gigawatt hour facility. Quite interestingly, they're saying that it's going to be for the storage market. So we are expecting, at least initially, a lot of this LFP capacity that will come online to be more directed towards stationary storage. That partly comes down to the shorter qualification timelines you do have for storage compared to electric vehicles. And then the other kind of big element of this LFP story is these kind of new startup players that are emerging in the US market. You know, there really are a growing number of them now, and I think there's a few lists on this slide. That's by no means a comprehensive list. You know, there's many players who are looking to get into this market. Again, a lot of those players are looking at least initially into the storage space, but certainly with plans longer term to get onto the EV side as well. And then the only other thing to mention, I guess, is we've seen in recent weeks, even the announcements between CATL and GM, and also the announcement previously with CATL and Ford. There's been a lot of, I guess, questions around that, whether it's going to be allowed or whether it's going to happen. I think the fact that now GM are also vying for this relationship means that it's more likely than when it was just Ford and CATL. Ultimately, what they'll be looking at is a technology licensing deal, which is the only way you'd really be able to get around the foreign entities of concern within the IRA. So, you know, that certainly will be something where we do see LFP capacity come online for the EV space. There's still, I think, a few questions to be ironed out and issues to be ironed out there. So we'll see how that develops, I think, in the next few years. But the general story is LFP share is set to increase. I think I included just a number on that slide, which was when we expect each kind of chemistry area to exceed the 1 terawatt hour mark. So for NCM, we're seeing 2027. But for LFP, this is just within the EV market, you're looking at 2030. However, when you start to think about storage as well, then that 1 terawatt hour mark in the LFP side will be a lot sooner.
And the dreaded sodium ion, how is that playing out just in the EV market?
I mean, we saw some models basically released at the end of last year. And we've seen the first few sales come through. So, you know, really is quite like a handful of sales we've tracked in our EV sales database. Right now, there's issues with sodium ion. Ultimately, what you're dealing with is a battery which is maybe not as good as the hype would have had it a year ago. A lot of the excitement around sodium ion happened at a time when lithium carbonate price was very high, which meant that LFP cells were expensive. You know, as we've seen lithium price, decline and stay where it is, ultimately what that means is that kind of price differential between LFP and sodium ion is no longer there. So right now, a sodium ion cell, the real benefits of that low cost cell aren't necessarily evident. So that's one issue within, I guess, just on the surface level of cost. There's also other issues, certainly mine, around kind of manufacturing is not yet scaled. Right now, your performance is going to be a lot worse. So not only is the energy density worse, things like cycle life isn't going to be as good. And that's more of an impact for the storage market, I would say. But yeah, the way we see it is sodium ion will come and we will see more sodium ion vehicles on the road. But I think the pace at which that has grown and is coming to the market is certainly slower than maybe was anticipated a year ago.
We assumed a $20,000 a ton carbonate price. So LFP cells remain competitive. How do you see, you know, the future for sodium ion under that scenario, given if it's in a vehicle, you've got to put more weight in and more cells in and so on?
Yeah, so I think some of the upsides of sodium ion, one, I mean, safety is better with sodium ion. So that's certainly a positive. So, you know, certain applications where people are really looking for higher safety, that could be an option. The other key one where we do expect it to see it come through is because of its low temperature. Basically the temperature range at which it can operate is much wider. So particularly if you're, you know, maybe in China, situated in somewhere in northern China where temperatures, you know, get down to real extremes in the winter, having you know, a sodium ion battery pack does mean that your vehicle range can be more consistent year round. So that's certainly a possibility. There's also, you know, people who are looking at things like having hybrid packs. So you'd be potentially having some LFP cells and some sodium ion cells in the same way that we've seen with NIO with the LFP and NCM packs, which would give you, you know, certain benefits, for example, that cold temperature operability while still having a bit more range. So there's a few different viable ways that we can look at it. And then the other thing as well, I guess, is really just around availability. So, you know, if capacity does come online in a significant way on sodium ion, which I think we've tracked over 150 gigawatt hours of capacity now planned out to 2030, this market is big. You know, there's plenty of space for these chemistries to, I guess, sit alongside each other and complement. So, you know, we will see certain OEMs or certain vehicle lines, people opting for different cell chemistries, almost because that optionality is there in a way, I think.
And now if we can move on to my favorite topic, the battery energy storage. It looks like there were good numbers last year, and this year, again, good numbers forecast. I saw an enormous addition of renewables into China last year. I saw a quote that said the addition in 1 year was bigger than the entire renewables industry in the US. So it looks like China is trying to lower carbon emissions. How are you? Is it 48% for this year growth? You know, give us a rundown and any changes in policy and in like to drought?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I think we've spoken about it a number of times, how I guess how impressive the growth has been in this market over recent years. You're obviously coming from a much lower base than the EV side, but you know, this market really has been close to doubling for the last few years. For 2024, we're expecting that 50% growth rate to just under 200 gigawatt hours. In terms of where that growth is coming from, a lot of that is China and a lot of that is on the grid market. But we are expecting a good year for both the US and for the European market this year, which I think is going to be interesting to see. It's really going from strength to strength as we see more renewables roll out. We see more markets open up for storage. So that's certainly driving things along nicely. One thing that I would say is, you know, it could be growing a lot faster. So we have a database which tracks essentially the grid storage projects globally. And when we look at our kind of pipeline for 2024, we have 220 gigawatt hours, which is due to come online this year, just on the grid market. However, you know, we actually only expect around, I think it's on the grid side, around 150 gigawatt hours of this to actually come online. So there are a number of issues in the market, from things like product delays, still issues with kind of high voltage equipment, where a lot of the supply chains aren't progressing nicely. In China, you have some issues around the profitability of storage systems or storage projects. So there's quite a few things which are still working to be ironed out, which are causing markets to have delays. Interconnection queues, another big one. So there's challenges, certainly, but you know, the market is still progressing nicely, and battery demand is certainly picking up.
And tell me, with Tesla EV cells, shall we say, cooling for this year and left off ramping, is there for the possibility that, you know, Tesla could have a big year on the energy storage side?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly make sense. You know, they have, I think in Q1, it was a record-breaking quarter for them in terms of deployments. Starting throughout the rest of this year, we are going to see more coming through from Tesla. You know, they Lathrop facility should be getting up towards full capacity later this year. So that 40 gigawatt hours is certainly going to make a big difference. Then you also have Tesla's Megapack facility in Shanghai, which I believe construction started now. So towards the end of this year, we'll probably see that come online, which is, again, going to be a big kind of pickup there. I think a lot of those megapacks will see exports to places like Australia, maybe the European market as well. So that's going to be a big pickup for the storage side there. But yeah, certainly it seems to be the case that maybe that's a bit of a silver lining for Tesla this year, is the storage business.
And I see LFP creeping up in market share. How do you see that going forward from this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a story of LFP dominance when it comes to storage. It's certainly not always been the case. When we go back to, you know, say 2020, it was a market which was much more heavily dominated by NCM. But ultimately, the kind of affordability aspect and the slightly higher safety aspect has meant that the LFP has come to dominate this market. Going forwards, you know, we do expect LFP to continue to dominate the space. However, other technologies are certainly on the horizon. So you know, we've spoken about sodium ion. Sodium ion has potential in storage. It's certainly not the best fit right now. We're also seeing quite a lot of movement in the flow battery space. Again, there's, you know, some issues there because LFP is getting so good for storage that it's becoming harder to compete with it. We're seeing so many dedicated LFP cell capacity coming online, which is really supporting this growth. And then the other key thing is we're seeing so many of these, so many cell manufacturers really looking to design cells which are optimized for storage, which is making a big difference now as well.
Looking at the form factors here, are you looking at now sort of 500 amp hours possibly and bigger, and that going into the, what, 4 to 8 hour storage market?
Yeah, exactly. So you're starting to see, we've actually seen one which is over the 1,000 amp hour mark. So they're really getting quite ridiculously big now. So yeah, ultimately what this means is, you know, you're looking at higher volumetric energy density, which means you've got this reduced cost, which means that ultimately it's more viable to have a longer duration system. Quite interestingly, you know, if LFP cells start to take up that longer duration, 4 to 8 hour, 10 hour even area, that's typically the space where flow batteries have been seen as sitting. So we are seeing almost that LFP share creeping into what could have potentially been a market for a different chemistry.
And the cycle life is also improving on these.
Yeah, definitely.
Where so, are we at? Yeah, no, I think we're over 10,000 or.
Yeah, exactly. So some of these players are saying cycle life up to 12,000 cycles, where, you know, if you're cycling your system once a day, you know, you could be looking at like 20 years for that. So there's certainly big implications for things like, you know, recycling, second life, considering things like, you know, even replacement rates for battery storage systems. If they're going to last 20 years, then, you know, you won't have to replace them so often. So, and then the other key thing as well is ultimately that brings down your lifetime cost, your levelized cost. So it all makes it more affordable, and it's going to mean that we're going to see more of them installed.
So this is what I want to hear, because I'm an outlier bullish on this. So from your number of around 200 to get to 1 terawatt hour in 2030 is just over 30% compound. So between the natural growth and eating into the bigger, longer dated storage market, is that possible? Is this doable?
Yeah, I think the upside is strong when it comes to storage. I think there's a good kind of example of it is when we look at the US market. So right now, in terms of where storage is being installed, it comes down to two states. So California and Texas are dominating that market nearly entirely. So the reason that storage is so strong there is because renewables are strong, and also because the market mechanisms exist that make storage viable and profitable. You know, there's 50 other states, so there's a lot of opportunity for storage just in the US market. And we're seeing more and more markets emerge. So in the European market, we're seeing lots of, different countries emerging. Poland, for example, is quite an interesting one, seeing lots of project tenders there. Turkey, we're seeing lots going on there. The Canadian market, we've heard from integrators, that's one to watch in the coming years. So really there's a lot of markets who are only just starting their battery storage journey. And that's where we're going to see, you know, lots of potential for growth and lots of potential upside in the coming years.
And your views on sodium ion in the storage side of things?
Yeah, I mean, as I've kind of mentioned, the cycle life that we're seeing with these LFP cells now are incredibly good and incredibly high. Sodium ion cycle life is right now is nowhere near that. So that's certainly a key consideration for integrators or, you know, even developers when they're looking at the different chemistries. So that's probably one thing that is going to be very key is bringing up that cycle life before we see, you know, widespread use of sodium ion. And applications, again, that having that cold temperature optimality is going to be beneficial for certain things. You know, consider a data center which is in a cold climate. Having a sodium ion cell could be very well suited for something like that. But, you know, in terms of actual projects coming through, we've not seen too many announced yet. There was an example last year of one that was supposed to be built with sodium ion, and they ended up using LFP instead because it was available and it was cheaper. It's similar picture to the EV space, I'd say, is right now it's coming, but the growth is slower than anticipated. And there's still quite a lot of work to be done on developing sodium ion cells before they are, you know, competitive with these LFP ESS cells that we do see in the market now.
Last question to you is, you just mentioned 1,000 amphires. So, I mean, how the LFP or ESS-specific cell has evolved. I mean, where are the limits to this thing? It seems like this phenomenal development. Potential.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I mean, the limit, I think, is quite an interesting one. I think I was having a conversation with someone, I think it was about a year ago, about what is the optimal kind of single cell capacity. And this is at the point where CTL launched their 280 amp power, and everyone was like, that, what, this is crazy, 280 amp power is CSS, so exciting. And someone said to me, you know, we'll never go over 300. 300 is, why would you want one bigger than that? And now we're seeing, you know, these 1,000 amp power cells come through. So, I mean, it has to stop somewhere. I think ultimately, you know, going bigger and bigger and bigger, you run into issues where if you have a defect, that's then a very expensive defect rather than just replacing a small cell. It's basically replacing your whole pack. So the sesame is an upper limit, but not quite sure how far people are going to push it.
But 1,000 amp hours, that's likely to be on a cost and cycle, as you said, on an effective cost, extremely competitive. I mean, dominant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay, great. Thanks very much, Alan.
I thought of a couple of questions while I was listening to that. And, So one is, there's a lot of negative press in America, in particular, like in the Wall Street Journal, and it's not just anti-EV, it's like our electricity grid, right, is just decrepit, right? And as a competitor or outside of EVs, you know, AI, right, is a big, big topic that will consume a lot of electricity. And then also cryptocurrencies and like Bitcoin mining and like, so that there are other demands on our grid in America. Have you thought about this at all? You know, AI, cryptocurrencies as a competing demand, you know, and what does that mean? Because the argument that the Wall Street Journal is making is that we're going to need more natural gas plants. We're going to need more coal plants to produce this electricity because, you know, solar, wind, you know, and batteries just can't keep up.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that we do consider. I think we've spoken a lot today about kind of our grid market forecasts and what we look at, but within the behind the meter side, certainly kind of data centers is a big consideration. Also things like telecom towers, you know, big user of electricity, particularly in developing countries. So yeah, it's, you know, the electricity demand from various applications is set to boom, and certainly batteries are going to be a big part of supporting that. We've seen some, you know, players like Amazon and Google already like investing into building their own microgrids or buying large offtakes from solar facilities. So I think that's something that we can expect to see continue, is particularly from these kind of big players, big tech players. You know, they're not going to want to build a gas plant next to their data center. They're going to be looking to find kind of greener ways to support them. And, you know, hopefully we'll see lots of batteries being part of that as well.
Okay. So you think AI and cryptocurrencies should be a net positive to battery demand? Then,
yeah.
Okay. So related to this is that, like, when we think about Tesla Battery Day, you know, 3.5 years ago and the 4680, and just observing Tesla and the discourse around it now, you know, is it robo taxis? You know, are they going to do the next gen vehicle? You don't see them building as many, you know, where are we with the ramp up with 4680? And that was meant to be kind of like the step function. There just definitely seems to be a narrative shift, like toward robots and toward robo taxis, as opposed to, you know, getting to 20 million cars. So if you can comment on, you know, Tesla specifically in that narrative.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was the Wall Street Journal article, which suggested that, or it was Reuters actually, which suggested there was the pause of development of the $25,000 vehicle. I think that's, you know, being refuted by a few different sources. So it seems like it's more kind of shift of attention. So ultimately project prioritizing developments of the robotaxi because things are going quite well. It's the platform that they're going to be developed on is going to be the same. And I think that's always been the plan for that to be the same. So those developments do seem to be operating in a kind of concurrent matter. In terms of 4680, production is ramping up. I think things have been slower than were anticipated. And that, you know, is a constraint for things like the Cybertruck. So, you know, it ultimately building cells is difficult. And, you know, Tesla will know that as much as any other cell manufacturer who's been running into those issues recently. So it just takes time. And that's the major difficulty right now, is just getting that cell capacity up and running.
Okay. Thanks again, Iola. Thanks again for all of your great data rich, you know, all of you who want to kind of nerd out on all of this, important, demand drivers. We've been very focused on the supply side, for much of this year of our discourse. So it's good to hear on balance, I think, you know, a bias bullishness, in contrast to the persistent negative narrative, which seems to be dominating the headlines. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Iola. Talk soon.
Thank you. Cheers.
Okay. Bye.